you've got the fuel with what you've been through personally to be able to do it. That mental resilience of knowing why you're doing it is the most important thing.
Hello and welcome to the Life and Death Podcast. My name is Stephen Rumford and I'm a senior physiotherapist at Ashgate Hospice Care, where I've been delivering good quality palliative care for the last 10 years. In this series, I bring together patients and professionals to have honest conversations around the importance of good end-of-life care and what a good death really means. In this episode, we're looking into the hospice funding model. You'll hear from Carl, the fundraising manager at Ashgate Hospice Care, and Tom, who has been a passionate fundraiser for the hospice since his dad died in 2018.
My name is Carl Jones and I'm fundraising manager looking after the community fundraising and events teams here at Ashgate Hospice Care.
My name's Tom and I'm a volunteer for Ashgate Hospice and also a fundraiser and also someone whose family has received care from Ashgate. So my dad was, as I sort of described when he passed away at his funeral, I actually described him as my hero. Dad was such a kind and selfless person and would always put other people's needs before his own. We always had a great relationship. Dad always wasn't the most tactile, I suppose, not the kind of dad that would, you know, take you under his arm and give you a big hug and a kiss and stuff like that. But he was definitely a character. He was the sort of person that would sit in a room and he'd be there at a party, you know, dinner party, and he'd just sort of take in what everyone else was saying and not really say too much. But then he'd just come out with some really quip remark, something either really sarcastic or just, you know, really funny observation on something, and the whole room would just erupt with laughter. He was definitely a character, I think people would say that. He was helpful, he was knowledgeable, he was like a walking encyclopedia. There was pretty much nothing that Dad didn't know, and if he didn't know it, he'd find it out. And I think he's probably passed that on to me. I always like to make sure that I'm constantly learning and finding out things. With my dad, it was he worked and worked and worked and worked and worked and then worked some more. So he was basically a workaholic, and because of that, it meant that he was quite often working long hours and we might not see him until sort of late in the day. Certainly as I was growing up, because Dad had set up his own business as a chartered accountant, he'd be working really long hours and would come in late around when I was having tea. And it's something that I find myself doing now to my daughter, Robin, who's 4, and she's got the reactions pretty quick now, but we'd be sat there at the table having tea and Dad would walk in and he'd sort of, in this ninja-like way, would manage to sort of poke his hand through between your arm and your head and manage to pick up, you know, a chip or a fish finger or something off the plate. And then he'd get you again, you know, like 20 seconds later, just when you thought he'd given up and gone away. There's loads of memories like that. Stuff like that is just hilarious.
Sounds like a real character as well.
Yeah, it definitely was. I can remember when we found out that Dad wasn't well, and I can remember the day really vividly, actually, almost like it was yesterday. Sort of wish it was in some respects, but I was on the way to work and got a phone call off my mum, and she just sort of launched straight into saying, "We think your dad's having a heart attack." I don't know, in these sort of situations, I kind of still managed to remain calm. You know, some people would probably just really, really panic and go, "Oh my God, I'm coming out, I'm turning around, I'm coming home," sort of thing. I didn't do that. The first thing I did was I gave her a telling off and said, you know, "Put the phone down, ring 999 now."
Yeah.
I actually didn't bother turning around and going home because it seemed pointless, because I thought by the time I got back home, Dad would probably be in an ambulance on his way to hospital anyway. So I carried on to get to work and basically went to work, explained to my boss what was happening, who was, you know, totally understanding and told me actually to just get lost and go to the hospital anyway. So I did. I went to the hospital, met them there, and Dad had gone in to see the consultants and everything. It wasn't actually a heart attack, but it was exhibiting all the signs of a heart attack, like tightness in his chest. He'd got some back pain as well. And they'd found out that it was actually a bleed, that he'd, like some internal bleeding that he'd got. And after some further examinations and some scans and everything, they found out that the bleed had actually come from a tumour on his spleen. I could tell, my dad could tell, that it wasn't just something on his spleen. They said that that's most likely a secondary tumour, so they wanted to try and find a primary, which they did find. So it turned out that dad had got a primary tumour in his lung. He'd got tumours in his spine, which is why he'd been getting back pain. He'd got tumours growing underneath the base of his skull, which were later on causing him all sorts of problems because they were putting pressure on the brain, which was doing the worst thing that I think happens to anyone, which is just changing his behaviour and his personality, which is not nice to see anyone go through, let alone a parent as well. And we just felt absolutely devastated at that point. And Dad sort of asked the question of, you know, what does this mean for me? Do I need to have loads of operations to sort this out? Is it worth me having the operations? Is typical Dad being very, very pragmatic and really sort of thinking about what the practical aspect was of the situation he was in. And so they'd said that basically your treatment will be palliative care. Our doctors, the local surgery to where we live, who were fantastic throughout the whole thing, they basically said to us that we could get the support of Ashgate. That's how we found Ashgate, basically.
Yeah.
Dad just went downhill at an absolute rate of knots. And it was a case of basically living at the hospice, I suppose.
Yeah.
I don't know how I could have lived coming away from the hospice and not being next to my dad when he was, you know, in his last moments. I stayed with him right through, you know, to his passing. And I mean, it's definitely not the nicest thing in the world to do, but I suppose to me, I didn't want to not be able to say goodbye to him. Sorry, I've sort of rambled on a bit there.
I think what you find on our side of the fence, the non-clinical side of the fence, is that we're constantly inspired by the people on the clinical side of the fence. We see what they're doing. We see the byproduct of their work every single day. We hear the stories of people who come into our care who require our services. This is my community, and I think that is the impact it has on me. And I think the striking thing for me was that within my first 12 months here, I saw 3, 4, 5 families of people, some one or two of them whom good friends, other people who are maybe acquaintances, people you went to school with that you've not seen for 10, 15 years. But I saw them visit the hospice. And sadly, of course, when you do bump into someone around the corridors of the hospice, it's not for a good reason, and that struck me immediately as this is why it's so important. This is my local area where I've grown up and lived pretty much all of my life, and the people that I've grown up with and know are the people that are using our services. And you know, every single person who walks into this office and takes a bucket for a collection, or is doing their own event, or needs a banner, or whatever it might be, they have a story to tell. At Christmas time, we have a big collection, so we'll be at supermarket. So I was at the supermarket, stood by the doors, and you know, 3 out of every 4 people do try not to make eye contact with you and duck their head and go past. And a few people give you guilty. I've put a pound in down there, duck, and then you know, a lady comes along and puts £20 in and said, you know, you looked after my dad. And I think that's the moment again when it just sort of punches you in the gut, because you go, you know, I'm just stood here and, you know, trying not to look too much like a spare part in my Ashgate shirt, you know, trying not to make the people who are avoiding eye contact with me feel too uncomfortable. But don't get me wrong, I'm a fundraiser, always a little bit uncomfortable. And then someone sees that logo on your shirt, it I don't think it ever leaves people, you know. So actually, to when they've received our care and had that experience, which, I mean, I almost stopped there to almost say that amazing experience, which sounds a really strange thing to say.
I definitely agree with you. I think you're wrong to correct yourself, because although, you know, you describe it as an amazing experience, it's just because we're probably not used to hearing amazing and death linked together.
Yeah.
What you do is amazing.
Yeah. And how has your family received support from Ashgate since your dad's passing? How's it helped you and your family?
So we've received loads of support from Ashgate. I would say my mum's been the person that's received the most of that support, because, quite simply put, she's the person that's most in need of that support. You know, dad was, is mum's soulmate. And I think one of the worst things is seeing mum go through that. Yeah. And her just, I don't know, being lost, I think, and not being able to, as a son, and especially kind of as the eldest, because you kind of, I don't know, I do certainly feel like as the eldest sibling, you feel like you have to step up and take responsibility and be able to fix everything, and not being able to do that, and just seeing your mum crying all the time, and, you know, which isn't, you know, what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But the counselling that mum got through Ashgate, so the, you know, going to the group sessions and having the one-on-one sessions and stuff, and being able to talk about how she feels, and I think coming to realise that she isn't the only one in her situation makes her realise that this is just part of the natural process of grieving, and this is what you go through.
Absolutely.
I mean, there's mum, I've had mum on the phone before where she's called me and she's just gone for a walk and she's just ended up screaming her head off because she doesn't know what else to do, because she can't do that in front of me and my brother. And then she mentioned that at the group, and, you know, people just made her realise that it's just what people do. People deal with things differently, and other people in the group had done similar things. And I think that people forget that the care at Ashgate isn't just about helping someone through a difficult time, whether that be because they are dying and it's palliative care or whatever else, that, you know, it's remembering that they're there for everyone else around that person as well.
Yeah.
Because the effects of end of life don't just affect that person that's going to be leaving us, they affect everyone else. So, Carl, we've come to know each other through, I think it's through my fundraising efforts.
Certainly the fundraising side of it was definitely the was where we really got chatting, wasn't it? Yeah,
definitely. So that would be around the bike ride challenge, wouldn't it? Really? Yeah. So during lockdown, obviously the funding kind of just dropped off the edge of a cliff, I suppose, through fundraising events. And a mate of mine, Zach Law, who's a phenomenal cyclist, I don't know how he's not a professional. I really don't, although he tells me he knows how he's not a professional. I think he mentions Peroni and takeaways, but even then he's still really good. So he decided that because of this, he was going to do a 24-hour bike ride on his turbo trainer indoors to raise money for Ashgate. I decided, you know, probably stupidly, I thought at first that I'd copy his challenge.
Mm.
So I rang him and I said, you know, would you mind if I do the same thing? I want to try and, you know, raise some more money for Ashgate. He was like, no, of course not. No egos here or anything like that. I've not done it for that. I've done it genuinely to raise money for Ashgate because, you know, it means a lot to him as well. I decided that I'd do the same and I'd do it on what should have been Dad's birthday as a sort of seemed like a poignant time to do it. And also it seemed to be far enough ahead from where we were to have the opportunity to raise the money. So I got in touch with you to say, you know, this is what I'm thinking of doing. What do I need to do? What do you think? Can you sort of mention it to people, get it out there, see if we can get as much money in as we can? And yeah, that, I suppose that is ultimately how we met.
The thing about this is it was also right in the midst of lockdown. I mean, I think this was a period where you were allowed out of the house for an hour a day to exercise at the time and so on. So it was really getting to quite deep into lockdown at that stage, and you live streamed it on YouTube, didn't you, which was for us a real event because I had your live feed on pretty much all day on a tab on my computer. The joke was on the morning that you started that we were all saying we're gonna have to do some work at some point because we were all watching you for about 45 minutes seeing you get going, and then it was really strange because then obviously through the night, which you were needing that, you know, that camaraderie and that kind of support. And I know Zach came and cycled on with you, didn't he? But I remember, like, before going to bed, just coming in, like, checking in on the computer, like I'm checking in on Tom. So it was an unbelievable 24 hours that. I mean, obviously, it was an unbelievable 24 hours for us observing it. What on earth was it like being sat on a bike for 24 hours and cycling? I mean, how far did you even go in the end? It was incredible, wasn't it?
Now you're asking me. I'd have to get my phone out now and have a look on Strava, but I think it was over 300 miles. I think it was something like 325, 326 miles, something like that in total. How did it feel? You could probably sum it up in one word, which is painful. painful and exhausting. I remember when I said that I was going to do it, actually thinking to myself, can I do this? Mm. I said to Zach, I was asking him some really, really honest questions, you know, about how he found it and how he felt. And because I know he felt pretty broken towards the end as well. But he said to me, look, you'll be able to do it. You've got the fuel, you know, with what you've been through personally to be able to do it. And I think he's right, you know, that mental resilience of knowing why you're doing it is the most important thing. Mm. And that's what really, really gets you through. That's the thing that, apart from my mum and, you know, sort of 20 minutes sleep at about 2 o'clock in the morning, is the one thing that really did get me through. And yeah, just coming back to that point about people not being able to go out and stuff, it was amazing because people were choosing their times that they were allowed to come out to pop down and visit. Mm. So obviously still, you know, maintaining all the distancing and everything like that, people were choosing to come down and say hello and just sort of cheer me on. And I think my local landlord and his wife, John and Helen, they came down with like a little care package for me. So there were some pork scratchings and some dry roasted nuts and a couple of cans of beer and stuff in there. Obviously, I didn't have the beer. I waited until sort of, I think it was the night after, to be honest, to have that. But things like the pork scratchings and stuff. And the one thing that they put in there, a can of Red Bull, which I don't normally drink that sort of stuff. Mm. But as it got to the middle of the night, I was really starting to flag. The tiredness was kicking in more than anything. Like not the physical tiredness, but the actual, you know, sort of feeling of sleep deprivation. And at midnight, most people are in bed and not cycling away on a bike. That can of Red Bull was needed and kept me going. I don't know, something seemed to happen. I got loads of people. So all you guys were watching and were letting me know that you were watching and, you know, popping stuff in the comments and everything on YouTube. And a bunch of people had come to watch me as well to finish. And, you know, sort of like my family was there. I'm getting loads of messages on WhatsApp and text messages and things. And it just really, really spurred me on towards the end. And almost make it worth doing. You don't do it to get the appreciation and everything, but it does help. You know, I suppose it's like when people run a marathon and people are cheering them on at the side.
Yeah.
It, you know, it does it does something to you. It gets the hairs up on the back of your neck and makes you feel proud of what you've just done or what you're doing, and affirming that you're doing it for the right reasons.
Yeah. And I'm not putting you on the spot because I think I can remember, but how much did you raise in the end?
I think it was 11,660 something pounds.
Yeah, that's right.
Or thereabouts.
Incredible. Absolutely incredible. And as you say, wanting to being inspired by Zach. So when you throw Zach's in there as well and add all the gift aid on, you're north of £20,000, which is just absolutely phenomenal. You know, it's such an incredible amount raised. And that was so inspiring for us at that time, you know, when actually, you know, we were on the floor a bit going, well, what do we do this year, you know? So, and I think that's the reason why you had all those people, including me and all my team and various other people. And I will put it on record that I'm not asking you to get back on your bike 24 hours right now.
Well, so same time next year then. Yeah, do you know what? I said when I'd done that, I'm never doing that again. And actually, I'm lying to myself. I will do it again. I would absolutely raise money for Ashgate. I don't know. I think the future for me is that everyone that holds Ashgate close to their heart, and indeed other charities, I suppose, but obviously I'm championing Ashgate here, is that we all try and find just one other person or a couple of, and they find another person, and then they find another person to do a bit of fundraising, no matter how big or how small it is.
It's people like you that ensure that we are confident that we'll be here for the future, no matter what. And so thank you for sharing your experience with us.
Thank you for letting me do that.
Thanks to Carl and Tom for sharing their stories on the Life and Death podcast. And thank you very much for listening. If you've enjoyed this episode, please rate us and leave a review on Apple Podcasts. That really helps other people to find us. And subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love you to ask us any questions or share your experience of end-of-life care in your review. Or let us know on our socials, Ashgate_Hospice on Twitter and Ashgate Hospice Care on Instagram and Facebook.